We still need one more for a quorum, right?
Yes.
Do a roll call vote or roll call at this point?
Yes, I will. Janet Brennan?
Here.
Jay Tufano called. Jeff Davis? Sandy Copeland?
Yes.
Sandy Swint? Scott Soares called. Scott Storm? Spencer Critchley?
Here.
Alan Stroh?
Here, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Bob Smith?
Here.
David Mack? Okay, that's it. All right. We don't have a quorum at this time.
So are there changes to the agenda, Richard?
No changes.
Okay, so we will, Tom Brokaw isn't here either to receive recognition for his years of service. What were we planning on doing?
Well, we've already done it, and Anne will show a, well, this is it. We actually, we're into reusable things now. We got him a really nice cutting board that's walnut and maple.
Wow.
And it's got an inscription on the bottom side of it that speaks to his 18 years of service and dedication to the district. And as many of you know, he was sort of, for many years, the chair of this august committee. So he seems to have disappeared. I haven't been able to get a hold of him, and we invited him to partake in this meeting as well, and didn't receive a response. So we also let the board of directors know of his service and showed them a picture of the cutting board as well. So hopefully we'll be able to reach out and talk to him at a later date. But in the meantime, we're just going to send that to him in the mail.
Is he resigning from the committee? Or is...
Yes, he has resigned. He's retired. So he's, you know, it's interesting to note, I don't think he was really, he sort of stayed through a number of administrations, and I don't know if he was officially appointed, but we'll be letting, I believe Judge Phillips is the district he's associated with. We'll let Judge Phillips know there's an opening.
Okay, so we'll, should I take public comment on any items on the agenda at this point? Are there comments from the public on items not on the agenda? Seeing none, we'll delay any action on the summary of meeting of September 3rd. So we'll go to receive a presentation on the proposed change to the designation for the state ozone standard. Dave Frisbee.
Mute. Oh, David, you're on mute.
All right, I'll share my screen. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So I'm Dave Frisbee. I'm the planning and air monitoring manager here at the district. I got a call recently from the Air Resources Board with the exciting news that they are proposing to designate the North Central Coast Air Basin in attainment for the state ozone standard. So something we've been working towards for many years. Ozone is formed through a reaction of nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds in the presence of sunlight. Many of our permanent equipment emit nitrogen oxides, such as boilers and engine generator sets and power plants, as well as VOCs. So any solvent operations will be emitting VOCs. And so those all contribute to the formation of ozone, which is also what is the main contributor to smog, as you see in this image here. there's actually mountains behind that bank of smog that you can barely see. The district monitors ozone at 6 stations throughout the region. 5 of them are actually operated by the district, and one of them is operated by the Pinnacles National Park. I should point out the black half circles are all the stations where ozone is monitored. Pinnacles National Park is where that's run by the National Park Service, is where we historically see the highest concentrations of ozone in the region. So that both state and federal governments have established standards for ozone. The state has 2 standards, one for a 1-hour average and one for an 8-hour average. You can see here, it's 90 parts per billion for 1 hour and 70 parts per billion for an 8-hour. So there's 3 designation categories that the state has for designating the status of attainment. One is non-attainment, attainment, and unclassified. So with non-attainment, you have 1 or more violations in the past 3 years. You're not, a region is in non-attainment. If there are no violations in the last 3 years, it's in attainment. And unclassified would just be insufficient data, but not expected to be a non-attainment. So just to clarify the difference between exceedances and violations, an exceedance is when there's a concentration higher than the standard. But if there is an exceedance that is extraordinarily high, and it can be excluded as a highly irregular or infrequent event. And we also have exceptional events, which will disqualify a exceedance as a violation. So a violation is an exceedance that is not excluded when there's a highly irregular and infrequent event. And so not all exceedances of the standard are violations. And you'll see how this matters later on in the presentation. The current designation is non-attainment transitional, which is a subcategory of non-attainment. It's designated by operation of law. If there are 3 or fewer exceedances in the last year, we are designated as transitional, non-attainment transitional. It doesn't include any estimates on the irregular and frequent events, and so they're not excluded. So it's just a regular thing. If we exceed the standard, we are 3 or fewer times, we are non-attainment transitional. If we exceed by 4 or more, we are not just non-attainment. So right now we are non-attainment transitional. So to reach an attainment designation, the 8-hour standard and the 1-hour standard must both not be exceeded. And they look at, the Air Resources Board looks at the past 3 calendar years. So the current review is from 2017 to 2019. So the proposed designation of changes to attainment is done by looking at the highest site, which is Pinnacles National Monument, as we discussed earlier. The 8-hour designation value, so designation value is the highest value that excludes extreme concentration events. So that's the highest event we've had in 3 years is 70 parts per billion. And the 1-hour designation value is 80 parts per billion. And so we've had no violations of the standards for the 3-year period from 2017 to 2019. So if you look at this chart, you can see that it's the number of exceedance days per year since 2006. And I wanted to show you a trend of how we've been doing with over the years. As you can see back in 2008, actually, let me explain. The blue line is this line here is the days exceeding the state 1-hour standard. The red is days exceeding the state 8-hour standard, and the green is threw in there the federal 8-hour standard as well. So back in 2008, we had 26 days where we exceeded the state 8-hour standard, and that has trended down every year since then, for the most part. In 2015, the state and federal standards, the federal standard changed their standards, and it's now at the same concentration as the state standard. So that's why you'll see the same line here. For the period 2017 to 2019, you can see that there is an exceedance here in 2018 that was due to wildfires. And so that's an exceptional event. And so that was thrown out. So from 2017 to 2019, we were in a team for both the 8-hour and the 1-hour standard. In 2020, you see that we have 3 exceedances. We believe that that is due to exceptional events from the wildfires that happened the past year. Those were both in September. We had 2 in September, 1 in October, I believe. So we did have several events. And with that, what's next is the Air Resources Board will post a staff report in January. We'll have a 45-day public comment period. And then on February 25th and 26th, they will hold a hearing to designate us as attainment. And if it is adopted, the ramifications are minimal. District grant programs will continue to be funded. That was one concern we had. And the other is that the requirement for an air quality management plan is suspended. So until the time that we are back in non-attainment, we will no longer be required to do air quality management plans. So with that, do you have any questions?
No. Well, that seems like great news.
I have a couple questions. So with the decline at the Pinnacles, that must mean that the Bay Area has improved its air quality as well, since most of those violations were from the Bay Area. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Yeah, it's an overall improvement in the state that is reflected in our own success. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we can discount the success that we've had locally in reducing emissions from all of our programs here.
But not to steal thunder away from our contribution, I think a significant amount of the work was done by CARB and motor vehicle emissions controls. And that's one of our largest contributors to emissions and violations. So I think it goes without saying that if we didn't have those reductions that are in danger of losing right now through the current administration, we wouldn't have been able to attain the standard. So definitely the reduction for mobile source emissions and vehicle emission standards from California have weighed heavily on us being able to make the cut here.
So I have another question, and it relates to air quality planning. We use consistency with the air quality plan for CEQA review purposes. How will that be handled? Just keep the old plan in place, or what?
So far, that's what we intend to do, is keep the old plan in place.
It's outdated in terms of population forecasts and population-related emissions, but you may want to take a look at that and... Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe just update the emission inventory or something of the plan. But that's an important part of air quality review and in terms of CEQA. So other questions from the committee?
Well, where do we go from here? I guess the only solution is to end global warming or whatever. Do you think that we will have, we can reduce it any further given auto emissions, get electric cars, et cetera, in the future?
Yeah, Well, that's a good question. Without a doubt, we would expect that in 2035, if there are no longer vehicles, new vehicles for sale, according to the governor's executive order, that that would greatly reduce emissions or even further. I should also say too that, you know, we've been sort of on the tipping the balance for a number of years, and they call it transitional non-attainment. It's possible that, you know, if we have, this is one of the problems with global warming and increase in temperatures that causes.
We can leave Tyler. He's not going to participate.
And you're alive. So if that continues, we could go back into non-attainment. So and then we'd start this thing over.
Okay, other questions? If not, well, that's good news. Good presentation, David.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, Janet, we do have Scott. I think it's Scott Storm. It just says Scott, but I'm pretty sure Scott Storm has joined us. So okay. We may have a quorum.
Okay, we now have a quorum, so we can go back and accept and file the summary of the actions of the committee meeting of September 3rd. Are there any comments on that summary? If not, yes. If not, then they have been accepted and will be filed. So now we'll go on to item 8, receive a report and provide comments on evaluation of BART role for IC engines. And I guess this is Amy's presentation.
Actually, Song's going to be giving the presentation. Oh. Amy actually got called to jury duty, so she's okay. On jury right now.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
And can you guys see the presentation?
Yes.
Perfect, okay. Yes, I'll be taking over the presentation from Amy. My name is Song Kim. I'm with the air quality engineer with the district, and I am here to teach us the BART rule for internal combustion engines. Today, I'll just give you some background information, the BART schedule, the key difference between BART versus BACT, and then our recommendation. As you guys may have known, this is required because the state of California adopted a bill called the AB 617, which requires an air district that is non-attainment for one or more criteria pollutants to adopt an expedited route development schedule that implements BART. However, that basically changes due to David's presentation that we are now going to be in attainment for the state 8-hour ozone standard. So that's good news. So just to give you a quick refresher, who will be required to do BART? BART is only applied to the sources that are subject to the state cap and trade program as of January 1, 2017. And these sources are all located in the South Monterey County, which was Chevron, Lawast, Era Energy, and Eagle Petroleum. So this is what the schedule was that was adopted by our board on November 2018. We completed the first portion of the schedule, which was Rule 441, which I presented to you a couple months back in February. That was adopted by our board in February of 19 of 20. And now on to our next phase of schedule was to potentially create a BART rule for internal combustion engines. So what is BART? BART stands for Best Available Retrofit Control Technology. As defined in the Health and Safety Code, it is an emission limitation that is based on the maximum degree of reduction achievable, taking into account the environmental, energy, and economic impacts. So to summarize this, it's basically, for example, we take an existing piece of equipment. And the key word here that I want you guys to hone in on is existing. So we take an existing piece of equipment and we retrofit the equipment to achieve the maximum emission reductions by taking into account cost and other factors. Now that we understand BART, I want you guys to now to understand BECT, because it is important, because it is one of our arguments that we are going to make that why a IC engine BART rule is not needed. So what is BECT? BECT stands for Best Available Control Technology. That means an emission limit that will achieve the lowest achievable emission rate for that source. What does lowest achievable emission rate means? It means the most stringent emission limitation that is achieved in practice, and it does not take into account for cost. So to summarize, BACT is more stringent than BART. Now that we understand the difference between BACT and BART, I want you to now focus on the two differences of internal combustion engines. We have two different types. One type is stationary, and the other is portable. Stationary is basically an engine that stays in one location or remains in one location. And portable is pretty straightforward. It moves around. The reason why I wanted to explain the two differences is because portable engines and stationary engines have two different requirements. Portable engines are subject to a state regulation called the Portable Airborne Toxic Control Measure. And in that regulation, portable engines are subject to phase-out schedules, which require them to install cleaner engines. And then we have stationary engines, which are subject to our new or modified source review rule called 207, which will require them to do BECT or offsets. And furthermore, we also have a toxics rule called 1010, which will further reduce the control the PM emissions from these engines, depending on its use, whether it be emergency or prime. And then lastly, these engines are subject to the State Air Toxic Hotspots Information Assessment Act, also known as AB 2588. And the purpose of this program is to identify facilities that have a localized impact, collect the emissions, report the emissions, prioritize the risk, and if the risks are significant, we will require them to reduce those risks back to acceptable level. Which leads to our second argument as to why we do not need a BART rule. It's because we all have these existing programs in place to ensure that the emissions from engines are being controlled and reduced. If we do decide to create a BART rule, how many of these engines will be subject? So we queried our database from our four industry sources, and a total of 8 diesel engines will be applicable. 2 of those 8 engines are stationary emergency engines, and they already meet our BACT standards. So again, BACT is better than BART. And then we have 6 portable engines, which will be subject to the portable ATCM, which would then be subject to a phase-out schedule. So we will be cleaning up these portable engines and be requiring them to install Tier 4 final engines. We then took those 8 engines and determined what will be the emissions from these engines. And over a 3-year period, we've calculated that the average emissions from these 8 engines are about 0.53 NOx of tons per year and 0.13 tons of VOCs per year. And we concluded that these emissions are insignificant when compared to the 2015 emissions inventory from our air quality management plant, which reported 39 tons of NOx per day, which equates to 14,000 tons of NOx per year, and 59 tons of VOCs, which equates to 21,000 tons of VOCs. So thus, if we did to create a BART rule for RC's engines, these emission reductions from these 8 engines would not significantly reduce the emissions from our 2015 inventory, which is one of the arguments that we are trying to make, that a BART rule is unnecessary. Thus, the majority of our permits that are subject are portable engines. They will be phased out by law. If we do create a new rule, it would only apply to one stationary emergency engine, which already meets our BACT standards, which is better than BART. And as you know from David's presentation, we are now attainment, or we're going to be attainment for the state 8R ozone standard. And so thus, in the emission reductions from these engines would not be needed to attain or maintain the 8R ozone standard, as our current programs in place is doing a fine job in doing that. So that leads us to our recommendation to give to the board that a BART rule for internal combustion engine is not necessary, and we do not propose moving any route development activities on this. And that concludes my presentation. And if you have any questions, I'll be gladly to happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Just to make sure I heard right, is the longer term plan to phase out these this kind of engine entirely?
So yeah, so for the portable engines, they're depending on the different type of tier. I'm sorry, someone's breathing really hard into their mic and just kind of making me lose focus right here. The portable ATCM requires different tier certification engines to be phased out. Tier one is already phased out. Then tier two is like 2022. Then a tier three is 2024. And then starting after that, it will be required a tier four final. So that is the plan of the portable ATCM, is to phase out all these existing portable engines that are permitted to be required the most stringent standard, which is the tier four final.
Can I ask a question about definitions? If it's on wheels, even though it's stationary, 366 days out of the year, 65, is that still considered portable?
So when you're saying like on wheels, so it's moving around different places,
Specifically thinking about some situations we had over at Moss Landing, where you have refrigeration units over there that are essentially parked vans of they're on wheels, but they're there, they never move, but they're on wheels. Is that considered portable or stationary?
I can take that one. So the regulation defines that if it is at one site for more than 12 months, it's no longer portable, and it needs to meet the stationary requirements for the air toxic control measure.
Whether it has wheels or not.
Okay. Whether it has wheels or not, it's based on a 12-month footprint. But a facility can move it throughout its many acres and have a different footprint.
Hmm.
That would still be considered portable if they
if they moved around even in their own property.
That's the whole reason they have it to be portable, yes.
Okay.
That footprint is there for 366 days. It's now stationary.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Thank you for the good presentation. And we'll go on to receive a presentation on an update to the diesel engine and equipment replacement program. David Frisbee.
Yeah, just to introduce this, every year we bring this diesel engine equipment replacement grant program guidelines to the board to update it to reflect program improvements that we want to make, as well as changes in grant programs as they change through the prior year. So we have a proposal to extend more funding, and it's going to help a lot more people have access to our grant programs. And we're also looking at a focus on electrification of medium and heavy duty fleets for electrifying those fleets with one of the grants that we have received. So we're going to have Hannah Muga and Alan Romero, who work on those programs, to discuss that more. So I'll turn it over to them. Hannah, you're up.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Hannah Muga. And just a quick reminder for everybody who's not speaking, please turn your mics on mute. As Song mentioned, there was quite a bit of breathing in somebody's mic before. So again, as David just introduced us, my name is Hannah Muga, and I'm going to start the presentation and then hand it over to Alan Romero, who will talk about the Community Air Protection Program. So the Diesel Engine and Equipment Replacement Program, short as DERP, as mentioned, is going to the board, and we'd like to actually seek some guidance and feedback from you today on how we propose to change our guidelines for this upcoming grant funding cycle. So just briefly, I'm going to give an overview of the changes to give a more cost-effective program for our constituents next year. And also, we'll be talking about the Community Air Protection Program and our goals for that program next year. So here, I would like to give you some really quick, an overview of just the main changes that are happening that we propose for next year. So in 2020, this funding cycle, which started in January, we basically applied the same priority ranking for the Community Air Protection Program, Farmer Program, and Moyer Program. And we ranked projects based on location. Funding priority was, top priority was disadvantaged communities, low-income areas, the half-mile buffer area between those two, zero-emission replacement projects, and then annual emissions reduced, which has been the traditional way of how we have run this program. We also had a max funding cap of $300,000 for grants or 65%, whichever came first. So now for 2021, we'd like to separate CAP projects from the Carl Moyer and Farmer projects. And for Carl Moyer and Farmer, we would like to rank the projects by cost effectiveness, which is measured in dollars per ton of emissions reduced. Then we'd the next category down would be zero emission projects. And we'd like to reduce the max funding to $150,000 or 50%, whichever comes first. Now for CAP projects, we will focus on electrifying class 6 to class 8 fleets in disadvantaged and low income areas, as well as the buffer zones, as we have done in the past. Projects under the DERP project that we've traditionally funded include marine vessels, zero emission ag pumps, diesel to diesel and zero emission off-road equipment replacements, zero emission school buses, infrastructure projects, and zero emission on-road projects. So here are just a few photos that show before and after of some of the projects that we have done in the past. Notably the Rachel Carson that's out by Embari. We replaced diesel engines aboard that beautiful vessel. That was a fun project. As well as, you know, our main agricultural industry, we've really tried to reduce our diesel particulate matter footprint out on the farms. And as well with ag pumps, similar thing, you know, going all the way to electric. So just to give you an overview of this past year's ranking list, this list we publish typically as soon as we have ranked all projects, it tends to be in May. And as you can see, this past year, 2020, the ranking was done by annual emissions reduced, which I have the blue arrows on top just to highlight the column. And we also focus on disadvantaged low-income areas. So you can see in green which ones landed, which projects landed in those areas that are pre-designated. And then on the side here on the right-hand column, off to the side, I noted that we had one cancellation due to COVID. They couldn't financially do it anymore. and also indicating how far our funding actually reached. We were able to go all the way down to rank number 16, which ended up being actually 14 projects. We reduced 68.5 tons per year. And the total funds used up this year was about 3.3 million. And the exact figure right there is 3,296,419. Now, this was the ranking done this year based on annual emissions and disadvantaged low income and buffer zone. So now I applied the change in our proposition to the same ranking list, and it was fascinating what we saw. So if you rank by cost effectiveness, which means you are spending the least amount of money per project, basically you're funding cost effective projects. The smallest cost effective number will be the top ranking one. And as you progress down, they become more expensive to do. So if you change the ranking that way, we would be able to do 29 projects. We'd reduce a lot more tons of emissions, 122.49 tons per year, and actually need less money to do the number of projects. So we're spreading the wealth much further. And you can also see the column next to the highlighted box column, the potential grant. We would also be applying that cap of 150,000 or 50% to all of these projects. And I did that already there. So as you can see, it would go all the way to the 29th project on the list. Now, given two canceled, but let's ignore that and just see how many projects we would have been able to do. So it's fascinating that we could do a lot more with our money this way. So I'm going to hand it over to Alan Romero, who's going to be talking about the Community Air Protection Program.
Good afternoon, members of the Technical Advisory Committee. I'm Alan Romero, and we're going to talk about the Community Air Protection Program. Over the past several years, there's been a steady push from the California Assembly and the Senate enacting legislation that directs state-funded clean transportation projects towards disadvantaged communities and low-income areas across the entire state of California. As a point of reference, 45% of all the DACs in the state of California are in Los Angeles County. Consequently, the majority of the funding that comes from ARB heads south. That said, the ARB administering the CAP program has allocated to MBARD $1.3 million for CAP projects. Next slide, please, Anna. So what ARB has done, it's been about 6 or 7 years, they developed a model called CalEnviroScreen, and this is the most recent version of the program. And what agencies can do is use this tool to define disadvantaged communities and low-income areas in their jurisdiction. So staff prepared this CAP priority map, and the legend reads as follows. The blue areas are low-income areas, the red would be disadvantaged communities, and the buffer that Hannah referred to, the buffer zones between these two are there in the orange. Let me see, go ahead, next slide, please. Oh, one more thing, back up a little bit, Hannah. So the intent here is that any fleet servicing any of these areas would be eligible for CAP funding. Thanks, Hannah, next slide. So let's go back and comment on the focus for all the areas that are in the state of California, which means DACs and LIs, and what's the significance behind all this? And as David and Richard have pointed out already, a large majority of NOx and greenhouse gas emissions comes from mobile sources. So if you look at the chart, statewide NOx emissions from heavy duty fleets, just heavy duty alone is 26%, medium duty 6, light duty 13, you add that up and you're looking at 40% of all statewide NOx emissions comes from the transportation sector. Same can be said roughly about the greenhouse gas emissions as well. Go ahead, Hannah, thanks. So, and if we look at what all that means in terms of real dollars and then compare that to health dollars, cost of pollution is significant. These numbers are a little old. I think it's safe to say that across the entire state, 30,000 people die from respiratory illnesses. And you can see that these numbers are not insignificant by any stretch of the imagination. One of the biggies, of course, is diesel particulate 2.5 micron, which enters the bloodstream. It's designated as a toxic air contaminant by the state of California. Next slide, Hannah. So we feel, and we're prioritizing the electrification of the transportation space simply because there is no 2.5. There is zero emission coming out of these vehicles. And some of the products that are available, commercially available, are shown here. The class, let's do it. Medium duty is class 6. Heavy duty is class 8. Class 8, the designation is 33,000 pounds or more of gross volume weight. And so what we've done is we've identified some of these commercially available projects or products and targeted them for CAP projects. For example, although these are not CAP projects, under AB 2766, we've already utilized some of these commercially available trucks. The city of Salinas was awarded two flatbed trucks and a utility truck from Phoenix Motors, as well as two shuttle buses also from Phoenix Motors, which we were awarded to the city of Santa Cruz for their beach trolley. This is a picture of the first one delivered, and you can see that it's got wheelchair access and it looks quite comfortable inside. All electric, zero emission. Next slide, Hannah, please. One of the more interesting products that's commercially available is this Class 8 Lion 8 all-electric refuse collector. And the beauty of this is that there's no hydraulics for power takeoff. It is 100% electric. And I think the better way to describe or show this is just run this quick little video. It's quick. Well, sort of quick.
Let's hope it loads.
Yes. While we're waiting for that, we actually awarded one of these to, again, the city of Santa Cruz under the AB 2766 program. And staff feels that these would be great target vehicles for those CAP priority areas. Roll it. This is the first 100% all electric truck because of the fact that there's no hydraulic PTO involved. Does everything that you'd want a good refuse collector to do quietly. These vehicles, by the way, are made in Canada, but are commercially available in the United States. This is the same company that produces the Lion electric school bus, which we've already delivered 11 of them in our area. Fuel savings alone on this conversion from diesel to all electric is about $10,000 to $16,000 a year just in fuel. I think the next is yours, Hannah.
What's the range of a particular truck?
These particular vehicles can be configured to go 100 miles to up to 150 to 175 miles. It all depends on the battery pack configuration.
So at this point, we just have, we'll open it up for questions. And like I said, it'd be great to get your feedback and guidance on what you think of what we propose to do with our program.
How are these vehicles charged?
Sorry?
How do the vehicles get charged?
I think you asked how they charge.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Typically level 2 or DC fast charge, they can do both configurations. So level 2 is a 200 volt, about 25 miles per hour of charge, whereas DC fast charge is up at 408. It's a 3-phase configuration and it can charge up to 80 miles in about 50 minutes.
Okay.
And I guess in the source of the electricity varies by whoever's operating the vehicle. Some of them might have solar panels and others would be on the grid.
Right. And a lot of conditions go into how much range an actual electric vehicle will get. Obviously, if there's a lot of uphill, if it's a particularly hot day or if the load is particularly heavy on that vehicle, you're obviously going to get less range.
Mm-hmm. I have a question going back to limiting the grants to 150,000. A previous limit was 300,000. Do you have any idea if limiting the grant to that amount would limit the number of applications?
So great question. I've actually spoken with a lot of the dealerships that we use for the tractor replacement programs. And so far everybody's input has been that, you know, most people would have still accepted the grants. Of course, there's going to be people that are just financially tight and they would not be able to do a program like ours. But I think given the incentive, they'll still be investing a lot of money if they were to continue to replace parts on these old machines. We're talking about machines from 1980, that any incentive really makes a big difference. And to give you a really good example is, we've done several projects with Granite Rock in the past, and our grant barely covers the tax on those machines, but it's enough for them to present to their board and to buy new equipment. So it really does make a big difference.
I should just say too, we've been trying to find the sweet spot, and this also applies to our incentive program for electric vehicles. We lowered it last year and we didn't get as many takers, so we upped it this year. And we can always adjust, but when I first got here, I can remember a few projects that were getting $600,000 plus, and they really weren't doing too much. So if we can spread the wealth around, most of our estimates show that people will participate, especially buying an expensive tractor and somebody wants to give you $150,000, that's a pretty significant reduction right off the bat. And we'll also leverage that with other programs if we can. So we do our best to make sure that the customer gets the best deal out there.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, if a company say has three trucks that they have to replace and they would normally go diesel. But if you give them some money to even that out where it's just as cheap to buy the electric, is that a good incentive for them to go electric where you don't have to convince them too hard?
I'll take that. Not yet. I mean, people are really reluctant to go all electric at this time. And even though the governor's order's out there, we think that there's going to be diesels around for a long, long time and their legacy fleets and all of that. But as battery technology gets better, I mean, just in the last 3 years, we've seen like an insane increase in the efficiency and the energy density of batteries. You know, in the past, we couldn't even think about driving a trash truck, let alone putting trash on it, because it wouldn't have gone anywhere. And now we're moving 70 plus school kids plus, significant tonnage of trash around on these electric. So they're going to catch on eventually, but I think the first adopters will be those that really want to be green. And also, I just want to mention, we're not paying for compliance. We're not allowed to do that. So if they're required to replace their vehicle with a cleaner burning under CARB law, our rules, then we can't use the program to do that. But there is an incentive for somebody to go beyond what's required, and that's when they can receive incentive dollars.
Other questions? Would you like a recommendation from the committee to the board on this item?
Yes, we're seeking guidance and perspective, and a recommendation would be really helpful.
Is there a motion to that effect?
I'll move. This is Sandy Copeland.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to support the proposed approach by staff for these programs. Any discussion? We have no members of the public, right? Okay.
And Madam Chair, we will need to do a roll call vote.
Okay, roll call vote on this.
Okay. When I say your name, please answer yes or no. Alan Stroh?
Yes.
Bob Smith?
Yes.
Janet Brennan?
Yes.
Sandy Copeland?
Yes.
Scott Storm? Oh, is Scott not here? Oh. One moment, please. Oh, no, there he is. Hold on. Okay.
It's
trying to promote him to panelist. He has a hand raised. So, Janet, can you go ahead and address his raised hand? Did he go over?
Where do I see that?
Who has a raised hand?
Scott Storm.
I can't see that.
I just see Scott.
What?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm having problems. Now I'm having problems with my audio. So I apologize. Anybody hear me?
Yes.
I hear you.
Oh, okay. So I actually had some questions before the vote, but I will ask them later on in the meeting. I have some questions for Janet. I think there was something added to the agenda. And maybe I didn't get it. Last thing, I don't have Alan's or Hannah's name on mine, but maybe there was an email later on and there was something added to the agenda. So that's my problem. So I'm fine with the current vote.
Okay, that's a yes?
Yes.
Okay.
The motion passes.
Okay, very good.
I think I'm not sure if I voted.
Yeah, I still want my question answered.
Oh, Spencer, I'm sorry.
Is my agenda?
And I need to call one more name because and at the end of the list, Spencer Critchley.
Yes.
Thank you. Now we have a motion that passes.
Motion. Okay, Scott. Nothing was added to the agenda.
Okay. So because I do not see Hannah or Alan's name in this agenda doesn't mean they weren't part of it. Got it. I think it's all Amy's name and David's, to be honest.
They were presenters, but the reference as far as
that's fine. I'm fine with that. I'm just wanted to ask that question. So,
right.
In my audio and my media system. So I'm fine with that.
Is that it, Scott?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll have a question for Richard later, but when we get to that.
Well, why don't we do that during the monthly oral report from Richard and the.
It's not a part of the agenda. It's a question for the.
Do you want to ask a question now, Scott?
No, I'd rather do it on the agenda.
Okay, Richard.
Okay, thank you, Janet and members. Just to go really quickly, since we last met, we had two board meetings and to catch up speed on that. We had a public hearing and adopted the resolution approving revisions to the Rule 426, which is architectural codings. As you may recall, you guys advanced that and recommended approval to the board as well. We also had a resolution allocating $1.6 million or thereabouts to our AB 2766 Motor Vehicle Emissions Reduction Grant Program. And so that's a significant amount over what we've awarded in years prior. And we've had some disencumbrances of projects from the past that didn't go through. So we were able to throw about 400,000 back into the program. So that went towards those AB 2766 final awards. And then the board also received, this is on September 16th, the annual report on the district's air toxics program, which you guys had seen that earlier that month. On October 21st, it was probably the quickest meeting I've had in 12 years with the district. I think we were out of the meeting within a half an hour. That included mainly a closed session. So there were no items, regular agenda items. So it was pretty quick. With respect to just general district updates, you heard the good news. As soon as we get it in writing from ARB that we're not in attainment, we're probably going to do some public recognition of that fact. So we'll definitely be inviting you to something. It's really difficult with COVID, so I'm sure it'll be an interesting event, maybe Zoom related or not. You know, the air quality business seems to be good, even though we have COVID right now. We've got our engineering staff is very busy. They're processing about as many, if not more, applications than we've seen the prior year. And we're actually down an engineer. And that's because the board put on a hiring freeze for the agency and we could not increase fees. So we're hoping staff's working really hard, but we're getting very productive in engineering and we continue to make a dent and our the work is continuing to come in. We're also making progress on our implementation of our brand new database, which is in Acela, which is something that Monterey County uses. And Amy's been working really diligently on getting that up and running. We had to migrate over from another defunct database. So it's been challenging, but we're moving in the right direction. Just also on source news, we issued a 30-day public notice to cancel the Title V permit for Tri-Cal Incorporated. That's an agricultural chemical receiving, storage, and packing facility. And they use a bunch of different and store a bunch of different fumigants. And they're going to be installing state-of-the-art technology, including closed-loop piping system and carbon absorption for cylinder filling. So they're basically reducing their emissions significantly to fall below the 10-ton annual emission threshold under the federal Title V program. So we intend to cancel that actually early next week. It's been almost 3 weeks, and we haven't received any comments on that. Under planning and air monitoring, we've got two new electric DC fast charging stations that have been energized and are open to the public. And they're both at Target stores in Marina and in Hollister. And they were installed by ChargePoint, which is a contractor and part of our Plug-in Monterey Bay grant, which uses AB 923 funds to expand charging opportunities in our jurisdiction. So far, we've installed 6 DC fast charging stations and 64 level 2 charging stations district-wide under our Plug-in Monterey Bay program. And we expect to see more on the way. We're averaging almost $2 million a year in grants to get those programs or those projects installed. Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program, the VIP, has received, this is as of a couple of weeks ago, we've received over 100 applications. 6 of them have been low income, and we've obligated about $190,000. So we've got about $270,000 remaining. So we're actually on really good progress. We increased the amount for the incentive this year over last year, as I mentioned earlier, and we're doubling low income incentives to people that are qualified. So we're trying to get people, it's a great deal for a low-income person. You can get into a new Leaf or a used Leaf for, you know, $5,000 in some cases. So the costs associated with those, if you can charge it, our maintenance is really low. So it's a good vehicle, and we hope that as more of these used cars become available, that we'll have greater selection for the public in years to come. Also, we just launched our Woodstove changeout program, and this is offering up to $1,500 to replace a non-certified wood stove or open hearth fireplace with a new natural gas propane pellet, EPA certified wood stove or insert, or an electric heater or ductless mini split heat pump. Try to say that really fast again. And once again, on this, we can we really significantly increase the incentive for low-income applicants. They can actually receive an additional $2,000. We hope to get this going, and this is available in our jurisdiction, all three counties. We also just are working on setting up our seasonal monitoring network in San Lorenzo Valley. I don't know, David, is that done? Be up and running yet? We were working on it last year.
We're still working on that.
Okay, so this is just something we put up every year to monitor wood smoke as the weather starts getting chilly. People start firing up their wood heating devices, and then we start seeing impacts to air quality. So we usually have this program run, fall through the winter, and then we have this concurrently with our Spare the Air Alert program, and this is a voluntary program where residents in the San Lorenzo Valley are asked to voluntarily use a source other than wood to heat their homes when we call an alert. Hope just to get people more engaged. I'm talking now with Breathe California about working with students at UC Santa Cruz about an education program on how to teach people to clean burner, not burn cleaner. That is by not using dirty, wet wood and by having really hot fires. We've got our zero emission school bus program running along, and we've got about 26 applications for electric school buses. We've already funded 10 or 11 of those or delivered. And we partnered up with Monterey Bay Community Power as well. And we hope to be doing another partnership this year to deliver additional school buses under that program. And then on outreach, I just want to let you guys know we've got a lot going on. We've got our own channel now on YouTube, and we've got all of our videos loaded there. We just did a video in Spanish, and this was over the wildfires. This is on the air quality index. I got a lot of questions, especially from farm workers and the members of the Spanish-speaking community that wanted to be able to turn somewhere where they could get advice. We looked far and wide for a translated video, and we decided at the very end to make our own. So actually Anne, with her incredible production skills and techniques, and one of our staff who's conversant in Spanish, we put together our own video. So I encourage you to take a look at that. We've also got an Air Quality 101, which is one of our air quality supervisors, Bill Chevalier, does an excellent job of just sort of telling people about what we do here. And then I may have said this before, but we now have a new electronic newsletter. And if any of you are interested in, authoring it or putting an article in, we're always looking for material. And that would be really nice to have you folks signed on to that. So get in touch with Anne if you're interested in doing that. Signed on with the Entravision for Spanish ads, and these are affiliated with KSMS Univision, KDJT Unimass, KLOK Radio, and they're actually doing Woodstove Changeout program announcements right now. We partnered up with Breathe California. They did a virtual walk early in October. So they got a lot of people online, and so lung health and air quality awareness provided during that walk. We also have a new video that's been running on KSBW. It's also on the air quality, and I was hoping that Anne maybe could play that for you right now. It's really short, so if it doesn't work, it's not a huge waste of time.
Yeah, here goes nothing.
We did last time, and the sound didn't work with the board. But
I'm clicking the little share computer sound, so hopefully it'll
This clean air message is brought to you by the Monterey Bay Air Resources District. Air quality here on the Central Coast is some of the best in the country. Wildfires have had a dramatic impact on air quality, and it can affect your health. Air pollution is constantly monitored across the Central Coast, and it's easy to see the results. By checking the Daily Air Quality Index online at MBAR.org, you can see air quality conditions at each of MBAR's monitoring sites. Be aware and check the Daily Air Quality Index. Take precautions if necessary, and breathe easy.
Good.
Yeah, short and sweet, and yeah, very professional. No animals or employees were harmed in making of that film, so we're pretty happy with it. And I would just like to say, and I like to thank Ann and staff. We've really made significant progress and outreach, and this is really helping the cause. So we've got a nice contract with KCSBW for. Not only this video, but also for including our air quality index as part of their weather reports as well.
Great. Oh, congratulations.
And that concludes the report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You just mentioned at the end there, Richard, that the air quality index. So is that's not normally done? I haven't really thought about that before.
Well, the air quality index is actually part of EPA's designation on the air quality. So what they do is they convert concentration to a numerical value that then they have certain set or cut points that distinguish between good, moderate, unhealthy for sensitive groups, unhealthy, and then hazardous air. So
right. And they haven't normally in the past been doing that as part of weather forecasts.
No, you know, we've argued that they should be doing it because as a public service, yeah. But no, we've had to sort of fight them tooth and nail. In general, the meteorologists are very interested, but it's just getting the brass at the various outlets to want to give us free service.
Just seems like it's a valuable service to the public to know that kind of stuff, especially of course, people with health challenges and then the cumulative effect, this gets more into advocacy, but just making people a little bit aware of air quality every single time they hear weather forecasting. I was just going to say in Canada, where until this year I go every summer, they have ozone reports because they had a more serious ozone problem up there with the hole in the ozone from CFCs, et cetera. And so you get these UV index readings every time they do a weather forecast, and it has that effect. It makes you aware, you know, not only of being careful about your own health, but just aware of the overall issue.
I have an app, Weatherbug. I don't know if all of you are familiar with that one, but Weatherbug goes by location. You tell them where you're at, and it shows the nearest monitoring, but it gives the AQI alerts. So lately I've been getting one every day because, you know, air quality hasn't been that great because of the fires, but that's been an immediate warning. It just pops right up on my phone. So, but yeah, I found that's pretty good weather app.
I have a question. The last meeting you indicated you were considering negotiating with some other agencies to move the office?
Yeah, nothing's happened on that as of yet. I don't know where Community Power is, but the information I requested from them with respect to their new building location, I think they may be having problems with their board on whether or not this is a good time for them to move. But I know that ultimately they want to, and they have a letter of intent, I believe, with a to purchase property out in the Marina Dunes area.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
That's Scott. Did somebody have a question?
I do, Scott.
Yep, go ahead.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, good. It's my Zoom isn't working like it used to, I apologize. I think they changed it every month, right? You guys can't even hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can.
I can't hear you. Oh, okay. I can't see you.
We're all on mute.
No, my video, I can't get it to work. So, yeah. So I, first off, Janet, sorry about questioning the agenda. I didn't see Alan's and Hannah's name, and all of a sudden they were coming and I was late because it wasn't working. Did you hear that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, all right. So I totally dig the move out of diesel and everything, Richard. There's two things that haven't been addressed. It's weight in agriculture, because you compact soil and then you have to use a bunch more electricity or diesel to uncompact it. And the same thing happens with the highways, because the batteries are still heavier than the diesel fuel that all these big things cover. And so I hope you guys understand that. And I don't need an answer to that. Did you hear it though?
Oh yeah, yeah. So I just want you to know, as soon as the governor signed it, I had like people calling me personally, sort of, you know, complaining about it. And what I've been able to find out is that it doesn't apply to every vehicle, especially construction type of equipment. Sure. And it's recognized that, you know, as I said, there's an energy density issue with batteries. And, you know, one woman even got really hostile towards me because she has some Ford super diesel truck that she hauls her horses with, and she couldn't do that with electric. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I can't time travel, but I hope that if we see as much increase in technology that we've seen in the last 3 years, in the next, you know, 15 or so years, that's going to be pretty amazing. So
and then I got to be honest, that'll be perfect. I'm fine with that. Well, it's the same. Your guys' highways, we all pay for them, but our farmland compacts in means more diesel and more uncompacting if you're taking heavy equipment, which is something I thought might be important. The other thing, which is really easy to figure out, is the stationary, you know, either well, pumps, you know, all the stuff that's like generators and all that stuff, can get PG&E to get rid of their demand charges, people would stay with PG&E and wouldn't put diesel generations in and stuff. So you understand what I'm saying? So we don't run our wells for 4 months a year, but PG&E charges us a demand time to have access to the energy, even though we don't use it. And I know you know about that. So am I barking up?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much we can do about that, except for there, you know, I don't know if you've looked into Monterey Bay Community Power. Another issue for a lot of ag is that PG&E doesn't even make it out to a lot of the locations. So even if you could go electric, there's no electricity there. So,
that's true. I agree with that.
So,
but, I mean, we have a bunch of major wells that we get charged a lot of money that we don't even use them. It's in case we use them. It's called demand charge. You know what it is.
Yeah, I do. But I would just encourage you to work, if you can, with Monterey Bay, which is now 3C E, which is Central Coast Community Energy. They're trying to work around the demand charges, and they want to offer.
Well, that would be awesome. I would do that, no problem.
Okay.
So that's good. Thank you for that. Last thing, sorry to hold everything up. We have a lot of problems in the wine business right now with disease and stuff. And Cal Fire is not going to let us burn anything for, I think, the foreseeable future. What do you suggest we do?
Well, we can't override Cal Fire.
I know. I'm well aware of that.
Yeah, we don't want it to have the MBARD fire of, you know, 2020. But, you know, we can talk to them, because, you know, if conditions are appropriate, even though they may have a general burn ban in place, we personally have been able to work around that, as long as we don't have, it looks like it's going to impact air quality. So,
well, I have ranches I wouldn't even have to burn on, because they're side of a wilderness, but I have ranches in the middle of Greenfield. Just burn a pile a day, we could maybe get away with it. Otherwise, there'll be no farming there next year.
Yeah, well, why don't you give me a call and we can, okay. We can maybe talk to fire about that.
Okay, thank you. That's it.
Okay, future agenda items? Any requests? I have no comments. Comments from committee members?
Okay. Thanks, Janet.
Future items, when do we anticipate the next meeting then? Would that be February or are we gonna have one in December?
I'll have to get back to you on December. We've been sort of mapping out. We do have some items to bring you. I can't think off the top of my head. I don't think we'll have December, and then typically it's dark in January. So I would count on February for sure.
Next one. Okay.
Okay. Any other comments? If not, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. Thank you.
Have a Merry Christmas.
Yes.
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas.
And a good turkey for your Thanksgiving.
Bye-bye.
Bye.